Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, May 6th. Currently 34 degrees, and we're kind of socked into a big cloud here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 40 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Wednesday. Happy hump day. We're looking at lots of sunshine returning after a few morning clouds. A little bit of a breeze out there as well. Temperatures will climb into the mid-50s in Park City for highs. We'll see those highs around 60 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Thursday, look for lots of sunshine, but we're going to watch a ridge of high pressure to our west. It's going to begin to start nosing into the area as we go into your Thursday. So we'll see a nice warming trend with our temperatures. Highs jump into the mid-60s. In Park City, we'll see those highs climbing into the lower 70s in the Heber Valley. Once we make our way towards Friday, it gets even warmer. How about temperatures climbing near 70 in Park City? We'll see those highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. Let's talk about the weekend forecast. It's a very important one, of course, Mother's Day weekend. So we've got your forecast. The good news, it's looking pretty good out there. I don't see many issues. We'll call it mostly sunny to partly sunny skies as we go throughout the weekend. Temperatures are going to remain on the mild side. It will be slightly cooler than earlier in the week, but still pretty mild as we're looking at highs in the mid to upper 60s in Park City on Saturday. We'll be in the upper 60s for highs on Sunday. And in the Heber Valley, we'll be seeing those highs in the mid 70s. On Saturday, and for your Mother's Day on Sunday, high temperatures climbing close to 80 degrees. So make sure you make plans with mom outside. Should be some beautiful weather for lunch outside on the patio or just enjoying a nice walk in the neighborhood. Otherwise, heading into next week, get ready for a more significant warming trend. We're talking high temperatures by the time we get towards next Monday and Tuesday, climbing into the mid-70s in Park City. But guess what? In the Heber Valley, we've got high temperatures forecasted to climb into the upper 80s as we get towards your next Monday and Tuesday. And again, we're looking at lots of sunshine and dry conditions. So the overall theme will be drier and warmer conditions once we get past today. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. In just a minute here, we'll be checking in with Jim Weber. Later on, the CEO of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, discussing some of the open space issues they've got going on. Park City Manager Adam Lenhardt and Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. And Sally Elliott and Brian Buck with Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History with details about the Historic Preservation Award that they've earned. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life with a very special episode about moms. You can tune in to hear Lynn and Mary Beth speak with their moms as well as other moms about the journey of motherhood with all of its joys, challenges, lessons, and certainly lots of funny moments. All of that coming up right after the local news hour at 9 o'clock. The Nepal Cleft and Burn Center opened more than 10 years ago in Kathmandu, Nepal. It was founded by Park City resident and owner of Foothill Oriental Rugs, Jim Weber. He's a longtime underwriter here on KPCW. He joins me now on the phone with details about an upcoming fundraiser. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Leslie.
You bet. So give us the quick version of how this nonprofit organization came to be from running a rug shop.
Well, being in the Oriental rug business since 1985, I traveled to Kathmandu because I was already in India. I traveled to Nepal to go trekking, and while I was there, I met some Tibetan refugees in the rug business, and we formed a company called Tibet Rug Company, where I design and market the rugs on this side of the world to other rug retailers, and my Tibetan partners in Nepal produce the rugs. So over the years working at my factory, I really became familiar with Nepal, and it became my spiritual home on all sorts of levels. And boy, if ever there was a country that needed help, it's Nepal. And I decided I wanted to leverage my position of being a business person in Kathmandu, Nepal, into something meaningful, and started the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center in 2002, and with the idea that it was going to be Nepal's first teaching hospital to teach Nepali surgeons to do cleft lips and palates, and also there are just a lot of burns in Nepal, and we were going to focus on cleft lips and palates and burn treatment.
And is cleft lips and palates, I mean, is that a more in Nepal than anywhere else in the world?
There are about four or five countries that have a high incidence, and the way they measure them is the amount of incidence per 100,000 births, and Nepal is one of those countries. So before we opened the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center in 2014, the entire country of 30 million people depended on surgical camps by organizations like Operation Smile or Doctors Without Borders to come in for a 1 or 2 week camp whenever they got a chance. And it just didn't meet the demand. We've really filled that void. We've really changed the medical infrastructure of that entire country.
Yeah, yeah. And then with the burn victims, I think you have told me in the past that it's as a result of they cook with oil?
More than half the population of a country, once again, of 30 million people, cooks over open fires. And, yeah, they cook with a lot of oil. And you know, burns are a huge problem in third world countries. People in industrialized countries like the U.S. or Europe don't really understand the significance of it. And we ended up building a 16,000-square-foot hospital in Kathmandu. It's really a significant facility, and like I say, we've impacted the medical infrastructure of that entire country. We've become the best burn treatment center in the entire country, and that goes to our staff on that side, all of our Nepali physicians who push this thing forward to the closest thing we can get on a limited budget to a center of excellence, and the Nepali government now refers to the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center as the National Burn Center because we've become so good at what we do.
At one point, you were hoping to build a second center. Is that project coming along?
It's coming along. We're going to build it in southeast Nepal near the Indian border, and that's the region that has the highest population density behind the Kathmandu Valley. And we know from experience that's where most of our out-of-the-area cases come from. So that's the logical place for the second Nepal Cleft and Burn Center. We broke ground on it. I learned from building the first hospital, things take time in countries like this. But we're going to build it, and we broke ground a few years ago, and we're actually going to put the footings in this year. So it's going to become a reality.
Great.
It'll once again change the medical infrastructure of that entire part of the country, which they don't even have a good hospital now. So this will become a first-rate hospital by Nepali standards in that entire part of the country.
And to support that effort, you've got a fundraiser coming up Friday night. Tell me about this.
We're just a Utah-based nonprofit. Like I say, we're doing big things halfway around the world, but we operate out of my rug store, and our main source of income every year is our fundraiser. And this year it's at the Museum of Natural History next to the University of Utah, next to Red Butte Gardens. It's might be the finest piece of architecture in the state of Utah. And that's where our fundraiser is. We every year it grows, and it's really a wonderful event, great food, music, cocktail hour. There's a live auction. There's a silent auction. Our main physician from Kathmandu just sent me a WhatsApp this morning and said he's boarding his plane in Kathmandu and he'll be here for the event. And it's really a wonderful event.
Okay. How much are tickets and where can people get them?
Tickets are $150. They can, at this point, since the event's just 2 days away, they pretty much are going to need to call my rug store, Foothill Oriental Rugs, 801-582-3500, and we'll get you registered. We also have a free shuttle coming down, at least from Kimball Junction, to and from the event. So anyone from Park City, it's really easy to come. We get a ton of support from Park City, and we really need all the people to come as possible. So please, even though it's just 2 days away, come. We'd love to have you come. We'll get you registered and get you at the event. And it's really, really, like I say, it's a wonderful event. When you leave, you'll know what we do halfway around the world. And like I say, you'll get to meet our main physician who runs the operation on that side. He runs the hospital. And when you leave, you feel like you've visited Nepal without the 30-hour flight.
Okay. How much are you hoping to raise?
We're hoping to raise $100,000, and it's not unrealistic. It's grown into a very successful event.
Okay. Jim, anything else you'd like to tell us about the event or the clinic?
I'm sorry?
Anything else you'd like to tell us about the event or the burn center and Clefton Burn Center?
This is a way to support a small grassroots organization that's having a big impact halfway around the world. And one thing I'm proud of is that we're really efficient. We're efficient on this side of the world in the way we run our nonprofit, and we're efficient on that side of the world. And since we began collecting donations 20 years ago, over 95% of the money we collect goes to the project, and you don't hear numbers like that very often when you support nonprofits.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. Thanks for your time this morning and your support of KPCW. We always appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me, Leslie.
That's Jim Weber again, the founder of the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center in Nepal, also owner and supporter of KPCW Foothill Oriental Rugs, Jim Weber. In the studio with an update from the Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Well, so for the first time in a long time, no conservation breakfast this year. How come?
That's right. Well, for a couple of reasons, but generally we are so busy right now with so many different projects that we're trying to get across the finish line. We also had a reorganization of our staff and a few changes there. And we realized that we just weren't going to be able to pull off the conservation breakfast in person this year, which is a loss for us because it's always, as you know, it's a sellout event. It's been hosted by Deer Valley for so many years, and it's a breakfast. So, you know, we're able to kind of get into the weeds of what we do as a land trust, how we save the open spaces. And so we get a great turnout. You know, we have state legislators, we have representatives from our congressional delegation, we have the members of, you know, city councils across the Wasatch Back and county commissions across the Wasatch Back, as well as supporters from people who are donating $25 a year to people who are donating 10 times that. So it's a really great event for us. So unfortunately, we weren't able to get our act together to pull that off this year. And so, however, because we are doing so much land conservation, we do still need the funding. So we thought instead what we would try is an email campaign. So we're calling it, we're too busy for breakfast, but we still need to bring home the bacon. So we do have two matching donors. So everybody's gift is tripled, basically. And we also have, actually we have three matching donors, so every gift is tripled. And then we also have a couple of opportunity drawing items. So if people donate during the month of May, then they'll be entered into this opportunity drawing. And those are supplied by Deer Valley Resort and High West and the Montage.
Okay. Again, that's through the month, and wesaveland.org is
wesaveland.org. Yep. Help us continue to save land.
Okay. Well, you're hoping to protect 12,000 acres this year alone. And how?
That's right.
How far along are you on that?
We are very far along. All of these do have funding allocated for them. So we're just working our way through the process. We've got one that's stuck in the federal system that's been stuck since December of 2024. We're starting to bring in our senators on that one to say, okay, somebody just needs to, you know, call an audible on that and say it's okay. We have a very large easement in Morgan County, which is adjacent to another 2,000 acre easement that the same family did with us last year. So we're hoping to close on that. And then we are working along the Weber River in Oakley and a couple of other projects in the Camas Valley.
Okay. Let's see. Coming up this weekend, you've got your Stewardship Saturday. What's happening there?
That's right. We are offering opportunities for people to come out and help us out a little bit. So we had one last month out at Merchant Meadows, and this month is on a property that we've had under easement since 2012 in the Hoytsville area. And there's some barbed wire out on the property, and the landowner would like to remove that. So in partnership with Sageland Collaborative, we're getting out there with some people on Saturday, and we're going to try to remove that barbed wire. So we can only handle a certain amount of people because, you know, we have to have materials for them and enough staff to kind of to be with the volunteers. So that event is actually sold out. And in fact, we have several other events that are also sold out in the month of May. And so what I just really wanted to say is that if people would like to be involved, go on our website, wesaveland.org, and look under the volunteer or the happenings tabs and sign up early, because our events do tend to sell out right now, and we'd really love to have give people the opportunity to get out there and see the work that we're doing and get to know us.
Okay. And another sold-out event is the next week's Green Drinks.
Next week's Green Drinks in conjunction with Swanner and Recycle Utah.
Okay. Let's see. You will be next week at the Mountain Trails Foundation Trails Mixer at Legacy Lodge on Wednesday the 13th from 5 to 8. What happens here?
That's a super fun event, and it's not sold out, so people can go. It's hosted by Mountain Trails Foundation, so they will be there talking about their work, and then many of their partners will be in the room. So other trail organizations, some profit, some for-profit, nonprofit, will be there, and others like us. And it's just an opportunity to talk about really how we get on to the open space that is so important to all of us. It's a really fun event.
Okay. People can just show up. No need to register or anything like that.
I believe that's the case, okay. But you can visit the Mountain Trails website to make sure.
All right. And then next month is the big launch for your summer programs. What have you got lined up?
That's right. All kinds of ways to get out and enjoy the open spaces. So we offer Moonshine Adventures, which is an opportunity to go out in the open spaces on the full moon. We also offer Mindful Mondays, where maybe we do yoga or Pilates or some meditation out in the open space. And then, of course, our renowned Hops Hikes will start up all in June. And again, we encourage people to go to our website now and sign up for those. We do charge a little bit because that way people tend to show up. And again, we have a limited number of space. You know, if we're going out on the trails or something like that and we have 800 people, it would be really disruptive. So we are trying to keep the numbers down.
Okay. And again, people can find that on your events tab.
That's right. WeSaveLand.org.
All right. Well, when we, you mentioned the Hop Hunter Hikes again, and the first thing I thought of when we were reporting that Top of Maine Brew Pub is closing, it was like, oh my gosh, what about the clothing optional beer? But it sounds like you've got a fix for that.
I'm so glad that that was the first thing you thought. It's like all those great years up at the Brew Pub, and now what becomes of our of Summit Land Conservancy's renowned clothing optional. And we had the same question. So we called our good friend Connor Brown at Offset Beer and said, hey, we need a new opportunity or a new option. And he thought about it for about 24 hours and said yes. So we are really honored that Offset Beer will be hosting our Hoppy Hour in 2026. And Connor's also going to undertake to brew a wet hop ale, which is what this is called. And so we're very grateful for Offset stepping into this space. We're also super grateful, you know, for all those years, 10 plus years up at the Brew Pub under, you know, various ownership and various management. You know, Neil's Impotent brewed an amazing hop clothing optional for us for many years. And we're really sorry to see that go. But we're fortunate that we will continue to hike for hops over this summer and drink them up in the fall.
Okay, is it different, this wet hop beer? Is that different than what has been done?
No, it's the same, and it just means that it's from a fresh hop as opposed to a dried hop.
Interesting, okay.
A lot of the IPAs that we get are, you know, they're dried hops, and no, these are a fresh hops. And, you know, the unique thing with clothing optional is that it's wild, and you know, they're just the hops we find out on the hills.
Yeah. And then that first hike is happening June 10th, it sounds like. And it's going to be where?
Virginia Mine Claims, which is just up here above Old Town. And that one is always a really fun one, getting things started. So, again, you know, we like to keep these to about 20 people because otherwise it's a lot of people on the trail. And, you know, Summit Land Conservancy, our people are talking and giving folks a little bit of history about the space and the wildflowers and things you see out there. And if there are too many people, you know, the people in the back don't get to hear. So if you want to join, bring a friend, go on the website and just sign up.
Okay. And then finally, you've got a date for your annual Blue Sky Bash.
That's right. The most fun way to save open space, although drinking beer and saving land is pretty good. Drinking whiskey and saving land is even better. And so the annual Blue Sky Bash will be July 31st. That's a Friday. We are so fortunate to be hosted by the Blue Sky Ranch out in Wanship. And tickets are likely to sell out. We sell a limited number of those tickets because we like people to have enough room to walk around and chat with each other.
Okay. Again, everything's online.
That's right. WeSaveLand.org. Those tickets will go on sale around June 1st.
Okay, and you've got an early bird price, and then before...
There will be an early bird price that will run probably through June, and then the price goes up at the beginning of July.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Cheryl, anything else?
You know, it's a beautiful day in Park City. Thanks for the snow.
Okay. Cheryl Fox, CEO of Summit Land Conservancy, thanks for your time. The Park City Council meets in work session Thursday starting at 3:15, and in the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have City Manager Adam Lenhart along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. First up, Heather, is at 3:15 is a presentation of the city's transportation system. The council being asked to adopt the proposed transportation metrics and service standards. Is just a change to how things have been done in the past?
You know, not really a change, Leslie, but this is... As I understand it, the first time we're coming forward to the City Council to really adopt a framework by which our transit performance will be evaluated. This is sort of how we're trying to define success. So how well we support safety, mobility, accessibility, sustainability, reliability, a data-driven approach to really monitor our system performance.
Okay, and I read in the staff report that some 52% of the traffic is people out driving alone in their cars, the council being asked to adopt a 1% annual reduction with the goal of dropping that to 36% by 2050. I'll probably miss that. But to do that, what needs to happen?
You know, I think what we're really trying to do here is give ourselves a framework to evaluate, you know, these various metrics and do exactly what you're saying, which is to encourage this change in mode share that residents and visitors are choosing, right? So increasing transit, cycling, walking, as opposed to choosing to drive in your car alone and to then park in the city. And I think once we're able to adopt a framework to evaluate that, you know, that will help inform how we help encourage people to take transit, to use these other modes, rather than bringing more vehicles and traffic into the city.
Mm-hmm. Getting people within a half-mile walk of a fixed route transit service is one of the goals in doing that. So how do you include the folks who live up in Park Meadows, Aspen Springs, and then, you know, some of the American flags of the city?
Yeah, we've tried to reach those residents through, in part, the 2010 route. It was designed to service areas that have less transit access. That does go through Upper Park Meadows. It reaches Erie Drive, Royal Street. And we're always trying to evaluate, you know, sort of sometimes competing and worthy goals, which are efficiency with our routes, right, to maximize every mile that our very nice and expensive buses are driving, while also providing more accessibility to residents in some of those areas that are less accessible by transit. Some of that is just the nature of the geography of the mountain town we live in.
Yeah. You know, to get people to ride the bus, you know, within a half mile of their home, I mean, another goal is to make sure that the buses are on time 80% during the winter, 90% other times. But you know what struck me is, what about the length of the ride? Because I didn't see any metrics that would incorporate more express buses so that riders can get to where they want to go without having to make a dozen stops to places they don't want to go.
I understand, and I think that's a worthy goal, certainly, and something I'm happy to take to the transportation team. You know, one of the things that we're trying to achieve in adopting this framework with the metrics that our transportation team has proposed is, you know, they see these metrics as the leading indicators of what really changes mode share decisions over time. So we're trying to adopt a framework that allows us to start evaluating those things. I think length of time is something that will come into the overall customer experience on our buses. But if we can increase ridership on transit and get more of that 52% of single use, you know, drivers getting on transit or using other opportunities for moving from point A to point B in the city, I think we will start seeing, you know, some impacts in that length of time, and it allows us to also evaluate whether or not our routes are actually delivering the service that we need, and whether or not we can, you know, shorten those routes to make sure that people are having a good experience.
Yeah, and you know, the buses, they go to both resorts. You know, not a lot going on this time of year, so why is that maintained?
You know, I think we want to make sure we're providing a high level of service to our residents. And I think we adjust, you know, some of those routes and the frequency of those routes as we go through these seasonal changes in what riders are using. And that's something that we're always looking at and trying to make good decisions about.
All right, Adam, moving on. Last week, the council adopted a fireworks and open fire ban. This week, the council will get an update on the wildfire conditions from building official Dave Thacker. What other actions is he recommending that the city take to ensure fire safety?
Well, Leslie, wildfire remains the most likely and potentially the most significant natural hazard that our town faces. And so the council's going to get an update, not only from our building official, but also from the Park City Fire District, Marshal Mike Owens, and also Chief Emery will be in attendance. And so, you know, it may seem a little odd to be talking about wildfires right after we got some good rain yesterday and the snow on the ground today, but we are still in a historic drought statewide. And those conditions can change very rapidly. We expect it to be another hot, dry summer. And so this update will basically inform the council on some of the preparation that the fire district is taking internally at the city. One of the things that we're trying to offer to our residents that is available, and we've actually seen some pretty good utilization so far, is that our residents can schedule a walkthrough with the building department. It's a free home wildland fire property assessment. So our staff can come evaluate your property, advise you as a property owner of any potential dangers that may be on your property surrounding your home so that you can be more prepared.
So this is the city of Park City as opposed to the fire district?
Yeah, that is a service that we provide through our building department. Again, the update and that responsibility primarily for fighting fires is with the fire district, but of course, you know, we do our best to be a great partner with them and work in conjunction.
Okay. The budget discussions continue. Adam, a lot of the work was done before you came on board. So if you had a chance to review it, I mean, are you ready to make this your recommended city manager?
Yeah, we're getting there. And so what's on the council agenda for tomorrow is the tentative budget. And as you said, we've had a lot of budget discussions already. This is for fiscal year 27, beginning July 1 through June 30th of 2027. When we're putting that FY27 budget together, we're looking at a lot of different things. Of course, we're looking at the current budget year, FY26. We want to see how that budget finishes out. How did we do, especially with respect to our revenues? So sales tax is the big one. Normally, our March sales tax report wouldn't be as big of a concern. In fact, it's usually a really great thing. But with the winter that we just had, we are anticipating that March's sales tax numbers are going to be down, and it's a question of how much. And so we're about 2 weeks out, 2 to 3 weeks from getting that sales tax report from the state. So that number is going to be really important to help us finish out the rest of our budget projections for FY27. So we're waiting on that. But the tentative budget, we've got two items tomorrow. The council's going to discuss it in work session first. And then moving into regular session, they're going to hold a public hearing. And by state law, they have to require that, or they have to adopt that tentative budget in the first meeting of May. And so that's what we're looking at. And what the tentative budget does is that's the first attempt at bringing all of those numbers together into a balanced budget. It's not final. I would expect quite a few changes, especially as we get the sales tax numbers. But of course, the council may still have additional projects and priorities. The budget is a policy document. It should reflect council priorities. And so that's what I'm looking for here as we try to finish out adopting this budget, getting it in place for fiscal year 27, is making sure that that budget reflects and includes council priorities. So there's still a lot of work to be done. One thing that I definitely think is really important, there's no property tax increase proposed with this. We're gonna maintain our rate from the previous year. Overall, I would say the city's fiscal health is still strong. We've budgeted conservatively. I think we've had really great policies in place to set aside reserves. Our fund balances are healthy, and so that helps us going forward.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we have talked with prior city managers in the past who have always said, you know, it's like to be so dependent on sales tax that we really need to start looking at incremental property tax increases. I guess you would want to do that first year you're here. But I mean, I guess what is your experience as a city manager before? I mean, is that something that should be looked at?
You know, one thing that's really surprised me, we attended a city manager's conference just a couple of weeks ago. I was surprised by the number of entities that are going through the truth and taxation process. We're very averse in Utah to property tax increases, and you know, I certainly get that, certainly respect that position. What I think we see many times in a lot of communities is if you hold off on a property tax increase, if it were necessary, if you hold off too long, then what happens is you're forced with one really big increase as opposed to incremental increases over the year. You know, I think a really good policy at the state level would be to have those property taxes at a minimum track with inflation. But, you know, that's not something that's done. I think from a policy perspective, that makes sense. But at least in terms of, you know, what we're talking about here in Park City, what we're looking at with our budget, that's not on the table, not something that's being proposed. Our approach is going to be to try to utilize all other efficiencies and savings and not increase property taxes.
Yeah, and I think what most people believe is that this season, you know, March particularly, was just a one-off. And I mean, why would taxes, final tax numbers really make a difference, you know, for fiscal year 27, just knowing that it was just, you know, once, you know, a one-off, right?
We all hope so. We all hope that that would be the case. I think it's certainly wise for us to look at that as a data point. It wasn't that long ago that we had a really great winter here. But the reality is it was a very, very poor winter. Everybody's feeling the effects of that. And we certainly are factoring that in as a possibility. What if it happens again? We want to be prepared. We'd rather be prepared and then pleasantly surprised if we get a normal or really great winter, and then we're in a better position that way.
All right, so you're waiting for the tax numbers before you discuss the employee pay plan and possible compensation?
Correct. Yeah, the city has adopted two pay plans going back to 2019. Neither of those pay plans have been fully implemented. The 2019 pay plan got interrupted by COVID. Of course, since COVID, we have seen extraordinary inflation across the board. Everybody's impacted. Right now, of course, you know, we're feeling it at the pump. We have a lot of city vehicles, whether that's police or transportation. The cost of doing business has increased dramatically. We are certainly trying to take care of our employees. I think that's really important. You know, the goal is to ensure that the people who keep Park City running, our snowplow and transit drivers, our police officers, our planners, our other administrative staff, that they can afford to stay here. We've seen that the cost of replacing an experienced employee far outweighs a modest market-based adjustment.
Okay. Let's see. The city initiated an independent review of its information technology operations, or IT, to ensure the infrastructure keeps pace with the complexity of municipal operations. What are some of the recommendations that were made, and what's it going to cost to implement?
That's a great question. I think the assessment's been really well done. I think it's very helpful, especially when we're looking at our staff internally, to have that outside perspective, have a group come in. Without any biases to really take an honest look at our operations. Right now, some of the key findings of that assessment are due to the staffing level and the increasing complexity of providing IT services for the municipality, our IT staff are pretty thin. And, you know, one of those recommendations in the assessment is that we do need to look at our workload and our staffing plan. We don't have anything in the proposed budget for that. For myself, coming into the organization, I'd really like to have a lot of time to work with them and really understand all of the issues there. Great people in that department. We're very appreciative of the work they do. I think as city employees, we always should be open to that feedback and looking for ways to improve and work more efficiently. And so I think it's a good assessment. They did a number of things to put the study together. They did surveys of all the employees, looked at workload, all of the tools that we have available. So, yeah, it's a good study, and we'll get some feedback from the council.
So was there a bottom line on that in terms of what it would cost to implement the recommendations?
No, not yet. The assessment hasn't gone to that extent. That's something that we as management will need to evaluate and try to fit into, you know, our long-term budgets and financial plans.
And as we know, IT, it's always an emergency, and then that means staff has to drop everything in order to go fix somebody's whatever.
Yeah.
So is that part of the problem? That you know, somebody can't get the work done that they should be doing to...
For sure. And today we're using more devices than ever before, and that number just keeps growing, all the different ways that we have to communicate. One area that is certainly top of mind for us as an organization is cybersecurity. I'm aware of multiple, local governments throughout the state who've had to deal with those types of incidents, whether it's, some type of a hack or compromise in their system. And that is a nightmare, and that's an area that we're focused on, and it requires more resources.
Okay. Heather, I got to ask you, we're talking about redesigning bus stops, and we've got $10 million. That's not city money. I mean, $10 million would go a long way in meeting other city goals, I'm guessing.
Yes, for the most part, the funding for the phases 2 and 3 of our bus stop improvement project is from federal, state, and county grants. We also have some other grants and funding that we have applied for that could also, continue to contribute to this project. So overwhelmingly, it's dollars that we've received to support the project that are not coming from Park City directly.
Okay, so what's the council being asked to do with this?
What we're being asked to do, or what we're asking the council to do, is to approve a construction agreement with Acme Construction for phases 2 and 3 of this bus stop improvement project. That's 65 bus stops. It will be 25 shelters, new traffic calming elements, new crosswalks, new sidewalks, those types of things. And these really fall into two different buckets. One is to improve transit access, so that's adding some ADA compliant pads, waiting areas, better signage, the shelters and benches, things like that, and also safety improvements, and that goes to the crosswalks, new sidewalk segments, traffic calming measures to really improve safety around the new bus stops.
Okay, and then real quick on the Recreate 248, the city's been asked to sign a $2.1 million contract for the preliminary engineering and final design support for this 248 transportation project. So what's the money going to be spent on?
So this is really the next phase of this project. As you may recall, I'm sure you do, the locally preferred alternative was adopted with the side-running bus lanes on 248. And so this is the next step, which is called the NEPA phase, the National Environmental Policy Act. It's the evaluation of an assessment of environmental impacts of this potential roadway project. So that will include, that NEPA pathway determination, environmental documentation, preliminary engineering and final design. It will include public, outreach, property owner outreach. This is sort of the first initial prioritized piece of that process in the NEPA phase.
Yeah. Given that, how soon could the city have those express bus lanes on the side running up and down 248?
I think it's going to take some time. I don't have an exact time frame for you, but I do know that this NEPA phase is a more intense and significant process. So we're trying to get going with that. This is definitely a priority for our council, though.
Yeah, and what's the design then for Bonanza Drive? Right now we just have one lane of traffic. I mean, if we want to get buses to Old Town, are we going to have, express lanes on Bonanza?
I'm glad you asked, because I was looking into this, and this relates to the current design of the Bonanza 5-acre site. Mm-hmm. And we are working with our development partners on that site to put side-running bus lanes, dedicated lanes, on Bonanza. And that is, so that's where we're currently at with the plan for Bonanza. And for the most part, we're trying to really absorb the impact of those bus lanes in the Bonanza 5-acre parcel, so that we're not, as much as possible, impacting property owners on the other side of the street.
Yeah, and then we also, though, have, the creek on the Bonanza side of things there. So what does that mean going, to the east then, on the other side?
They are pushing into, that side of Bonanza into the 5-acre parcel. We don't have final designs yet, but our transit team has been working very directly with our development partner on the 5-acre site to achieve those bus lanes.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Heather Snedden, Adam Lenhardt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Silver King Coalition Mine Headframe Building, a major historic mining structure at the base of the Bonanza Chairlift at Park City Mountain, has received a Rehabilitation and Restoration Award from Preservation Utah after a multi-year effort saved it from potential collapse. In the studio with details, I have the project manager, Brian Buck, along with Sally Elliott, founder and co-chairman of the Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
So, Sally, this award, I mean, was it something that you applied for or was something that the state just recognized the project for?
Well, Tina Lewis got me involved in Preservation Utah about 100 years ago, and I stuck around long enough to chair it for a number of years, so it's one of those little foot in the door that I have had for years and years, and frankly, that's where I got a lot of learning about how to preserve and how to find the money and how to keep it going. So it was a two-way street, very, very valuable recognition. Oh. And of course, we do this to repair the buildings.
Sure.
But in the process, we get lots of publicity. Thank you for having us on this morning.
You bet. Well, Brian, the headframe building was nearly lost. I mean, it has stood vacant for decades, and it was on really on top of a mine shaft that could have collapsed at any point. So I guess what was involved in bringing it back from near extinction?
You're right in your description. The Silver King shaft was partially filled with earth back in the 1990s when they built the Bonanza lift station and filled in Woodside Gulch at that location. And so the building experienced some damage just from that. But that had settled, and the top of the shaft was beginning to cave. And if it sounds like what happened at the Daily West, that's what we were afraid of. And so we needed to get that shaft stabilized so it wouldn't collapse any further. And we were able to team, luckily we were able to team with the state of Utah Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining, and they were tremendous to help us get that shaft stabilized and closed permanently. And then that allowed us to go and preserve the rest of the building, because it would have been unwise to spend our donors' money to try to repair the building itself if there was a potential for the shaft to collapse and take the whole thing with it.
Yeah, so what did you pour down there? Just more dirt, or is there like concrete or something?
Styrofoam?
Yes. We hired an engineering firm that specializes in this kind of mine closure, and I learned that they use a polyurethane foam as a structural member for these shaft closures, and you pour this stuff in as a liquid, and it expands into this really strong foam that attaches to the sides of the shaft and becomes like a cork, if you will. And it seals the shaft. And then on top of that, they put in crushed rock. And then there's an 18-inch thick concrete slab on top of all of that. So that shaft is permanently closed. And we've spent a total of 5 years and almost $1.6 million to do the repair work on that building.
So how secure is that building now? I mean, could it withstand an earthquake?
I don't know about that. We did not do structural work on the walls of the building, and that's, of course, where you need to have structural support for shaking from a earthquake. But what we did do is we completely rebuilt the roof, because if you've hiked or skied up past that building in the last couple years, you've seen the roof in different states of disrepair, and a lot of it was just collapsed. And so we ended up dismantling the roof, rebuilding the structure. The steel structure with new steel, and then repairing the roof on top of that structure. So that we did do.
Yeah. And all of the windows out of there, they were pulled out and then reinstalled?
So the windows had been completely vandalized since that facility closed.
Something like 149 windows or something?
Well, there's on the exterior windows, there's almost 1,400 window panes. And then there's an additional 250-some interior window panes. With few exceptions, they were all broken. Every glass pane was broken. And so what we had to do is remove all that broken glass. And for the exterior windows on the ground floor, we backed those windows up with steel security grids. So we did not replace the glass, because that would be foolish, but to provide the security so people can't just crawl in, we put in the security grids on the ground floor windows.
Okay, so open air now, and you know, it people is. With their BB guns can't have target practice.
That's right.
Okay. I guess, what part of that restoration are you most proud of?
You know, I think that the closure of the shaft itself, working with the state of Utah, and it's not just that, we did a very complex shaft closure up at Thames last year, again working with the state of Utah, and it's a public-private collaboration there. You can't really appreciate it because it's all underground, but the state of Utah spent over $350,000 to close those two shafts, and it was a very complex project, took years to do it, and it was really rewarding for myself and the folks with the state to collaborate on the design and the construction of those.
Yeah, so should we be at all concerned about any environmental issues with foam in the ground and affecting groundwater?
I think in 2,000 years people are going to go digging into that and say, what in the world was this?
Actually, the city water department, because much of the city drinking water comes from the Spiro Tunnel, and the Thames shaft is connected to the Spiro Tunnel, we did have the foam analyzed for potential environmental contaminants, and it passed with flying colors. So. We're not concerned about any future contamination.
Okay, and Sally, I mean, I guess, why was saving the Silver King head frame so important to your organization?
Well, the Silver King was probably the most financially successful mine in the whole bunch of things. It was an enormously rich mine, and it gave us some of our greatest characters, Tom Kearns and David Keith and John Judge and Jim Ivers. It really provided us with wonderful human interest stories that we love to tell our hikers and bikers and history lovers. So the Silver King was enormous and very, very rich.
Yeah. And I guess, how did you build public support for a project that's, you know, miles up a mountain?
Beats me. Except that from the minute we first conceived this idea of repairing all the old mines, people like Brian Buck have come wandering out of the woodwork, as he did when we first started, to say, Sally, I can't do it right now, but when you get this thing going, I want to be a part of it. But a lot of people have gone, well, I wouldn't have done the whole thing, but golly, now that it's going, let me do this little part of it. So it hasn't been a problem to find money and support, and people with the amount of expertise they have is just bowling me over.
Yeah, and we have millions that ski by it, right? Because it's right there.
Everybody sees it.
Yeah, yeah. Real quick, because I don't want to run out of time, but you've got a couple of public presentations happening. One is tomorrow. The Park City Historic Preservation Board will be honoring you.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Yes. At City Council meeting at 6 o'clock, I think, something like that.
Yeah, 5:30 tomorrow at City Hall, the Cindy Matsumoto Historical Award will be provided with that. And they'll be unveiling the art piece that goes along with being awarded that. And then we'll be at the...
next Wednesday, you're going to be at the Jim Sandy Auditorium.
Yes.
Yes. I'll be doing a presentation on preserving the Park City mining sites. And for people who want to see what happened before and after on the inside of the Silver King building, we've got a lot of photographs to share during that presentation. Mm-hmm. But what I was thinking about is that the McPolin Barn, that happens this Friday. And it's the City Historic Preservation Celebration at McPolin, and that will be from 4 to 6, and it's sponsored by the Park City Museum and by the city and Preservation Utah and others, and so we'll be there as well.
Okay, people can just show up?
Just show up.
Yeah,
between 3 and 6, hop on your bike and ride on out. There's no parking out there, or precious little parking out there. Okay. But I think you can ride a bus.
All right. And then, Sally, you're going to, this Silver King head frame will be actually part of the historic mine route that's launching this year?
Yes, that will launch on Miner's Day, and we'll have a ceremony, and you'll be invited to cover it. And we can't nail Wayne McKay down to tell us exactly what he has in mind. He's the project manager and the dreamer on that project. Without him, it wouldn't have happened. And so it's a 7.5 mile door to door from the museum up Treasure Hill to see a whole bunch of different mining locations. It'll be fascinating.
Okay.
More to come on that.
Okay. All right. Well, again, congratulations, Brian. Great work to see that it's been another one saved.
We've just had to open up a larger venue for the people who want to come and hear him talk. He's a great speaker, and we're just blessed to have him.
Okay, that's next Wednesday, the 13th, 5 p.m. at the Jim Santee Auditorium.
Yep. Yes, it is.
Thank you very much. All right,
thanks, Leslie.
Sally Elliott, Brian Buck, thanks so much. Gosh, remember Ted Turner, founder of CNN, other cable channels? He has died. What a great representative of the broadcast medium. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.